Appreciate the opportunity to speak in the symposium. It's been very interesting so far. I'm going to speak about whiteflies, Bemisia tabaci, something that both John Plumbo and myself started our careers out in Arizona about 18 years ago fighting when the bee biotype first invaded Arizona. So it's something we've invested a lot of time in developing IPM programs, and we're always hopeful that they're being adopted, and certainly the industry still exists, so I guess that's one measure. We feel like the fact that we have a fall vegetable, fall melon and vegetable industry, that those are indicators that things are going well. However, we wanted to invest more time in doing an actual evaluation, a direct evaluation of whether these guidelines are being adopted or not, and we'll dedicate comments about resistance management in particular. This has already been covered by a couple speakers, both here and in other sessions, but I think it's good to step back and look at resistance theory and in practice, because I think we have kind of a problem with rhetoric. In academic circles, we certainly know what resistance is in terms of reduced susceptibility, as shown in many of these bioassays, but typically we're also looking at performance reductions in very careful assays done in the field, and ultimately if a grower is changing his management practices, and that's a surefire indication that the resistance has had a consequence that makes a difference out there in the real world. And not everybody has the same perspective. Even IRAC tends to go with this definition that there must be a change in management. However, any of the more academic definitions of resistance really focus on just the change in susceptibility. And that can get us into trouble when we're trying to teach growers about resistance management. And to use pyraproxifen, or NAC, an insect growth regulator that we depend on, several years back, Tim Denhe showed in bioassays that we do have reduced susceptibilities in our populations in Arizona, probably been in place for at least 5 years. But through very detailed performance evaluations in the field, we really haven't seen significant changes in those measurements, and there really haven't been any changes in management on the part of the grower. Well, with imidacloprid, which is a neonicotinoid and the first neonicotinoid registered, I'm going to try to fill in those boxes as we go through this talk. So whiteflies are a concern to us and resistance management along with it because it's a polyphagous pest. And Arizona is a year-round cropping system. Not on every single acre do we see four crops on them, but typically we do have regions that support winter vegetables, spring melons, and summer cotton, and then fall melons, all of which are great hosts for whiteflies, and all of which share these whitefly problems and issues with resistance. We talk about resistance management within the context of our cross-commodity IPM plans. This is a good template for explaining to growers how we manage whiteflies completely, integrated with all the tactics, but I'm going to focus just on these resistance management questions and this issue of cross-commodity cooperation. We developed guidelines, a very simple set of guidelines ultimately for a fairly complex system. This was done, John Palumbo took the lead in a what we call a stakeholder engaged process. It was not a desktop exercise. This was something that was done over a year-long series of discussions and interactions with pest managers and growers to find out what could be feasible, and then hopefully develop and deploy ecologically relevant guidelines. And when you look at our system, it's quite clear that the risks are not the same across all landscapes. And in these two pictures, you can see on the left here a rather simple system where the white is cotton and the gray is non-host or non-treated host for whiteflies. The risks for a neonicotinoid resistance here might be quite different than in a more complex region, a multi-crop region where you have green for vegetables, orange for melons, and white for cotton. You basically have that four season of cropping system that I illustrated earlier. And just to show this a little more detail, here's just a model of a population growth through time. You can see that whiteflies can go through 13 generations. Here's the past pattern of neonicotinoid use, mainly imidacloprid use. These are the windows in which the residues are present in spring melons and fall melons and in winter vegetables. That was essentially our de facto practice for about 10 years. And we really hadn't seen any changes in susceptibility or changes in management practices. But the potential changed in the early 2000s with the registration of new neonicotinoids and new cross registrations into cotton. We really had the potential now where if unabated, growers could use neonicotinoids almost all year round. And we really didn't perceive that as a very sustainable solution. So there's high risks here. Instead, we wanted to advocate for our de facto program, which depended on the use of selective insect growth regulators and other selective chemistries in the cotton season instead of neonicotinoids, and effectively preserve this neonicotinoid-free period. And there are incentives to doing this, and there need to be incentives to get growers to adopt anything. And one thing that growers that lived through the early 90s learned is there's an area-wide impact to poor management across the landscape. No matter how good your management practices are, if your neighbors are very poor, then you're going to end up with big problems. So this issue of area-wide pressure or area-wide impact is very important, and it really does depend on very stable systems of management across all the different cropping systems within your region. So there is incentive for them to adopt resistance management. It is abstract, but this is a little more concrete. This is a series of studies that John Palumbo initiated in 1993, really an outstanding data set. I can't say enough about it, but in 1993, Admire was registered under Section 18 and first used, and in that time, John ran a series of replicated commercial evaluations, very careful performance evaluations, and showed that where he excluded the Admire or the imidacloprid from the commercial treatment, you have very high high populations. These are large nymphs per square centimeter. And the Admire did an excellent job in controlling, but still very high levels at that time because of the extreme pressure on the community. Later on, there was more widespread use of Admire, and we saw an order of magnitude lowering in the densities in the untreated and the Admire standard. And still later, when the IGRs were introduced into cotton, we really reached another order of magnitude lowering in the population and what we refer to as area-wide suppression. Now, there are some blips over here. In 05, we had an outbreak year. The guidelines I'll be talking about were introduced in 03, so keep that in mind. And then there's some things happening out here at the end that we'll want to talk about as well. So I don't have time to go into all the guidelines, and not all the guidelines focus just on neonicotinoids, but that is the principal interest in protecting that class. But this is how it breaks down. If you're growing cotton in a cotton-intensive community where there's inherently lower risk, we recommend no more than two non-consecutive uses of a neonicotinoid, no matter how it's deployed, seed, soil, or foliar. If you're growing cotton in a cotton-melon system, you can share those two uses between cotton and melons. And most interesting is in a multi-crop region, that cotton grower is effectively saying, I'm going to forego all use of neonicotinoids in favor of deploying those uses where they're really needed in melons and vegetables. Now, the question is, would that be adopted? Now, there were spatial considerations that I need to mention here. Over what scale does this occur? Well, we define whitefly communities as all those sensitive hosts within a 2-mile radius. Now, there's some assumptions here. One is there's an ecological assumption, which is based on flight biology and movement research that I can't have time to go into right now. But also there's a perceptual assumption, and that is that these pest control advisors or these professional consultants that help growers manage their crops, that they can identify and anticipate these production patterns adequately. Because these crops are not all grown at the same time. They have to know that, in fact, vegetables will be planted in the winter season in the nearby region in order to make a decision in cotton, for instance. So these cross-commodity agreements were sought and got from these grower groups and participating growers and PCAs. And it's effectively, if we look at a mosaic of the state, you have many thousands of potential communities. And there's cotton-intensive ones where two uses in cotton would be allowed, some cotton-melon communities, and then these more complex multi-crop communities. And essentially, we have a hypothesis here that in the multi-crop community, we should be able to see a significant decline in neonicotinoid use compared to those in a cotton-intensive community where they have free access to two non-consecutive uses. Now, you need some data in order to test these hypotheses. One is a series of 1080 data. This is pesticide use reporting data. It's not 100%, but it's pretty darn good for many of the chemistries that we're looking at in cotton. It's only section level resolution, and I'll say more about the spatial aspect of that in a moment. But these are reported by growers or applicators, and we work with the Arizona Department of Agriculture to accumulate and analyze these data, and it has all the important pieces of information that we need. In addition, you need accurate crop maps, and we can get that either through the pesticide use data or infer it from that, or we can work with a local cotton grower agency that actually has all of the agricultural fields geo-referenced. And so we have a crop map here of the Yuma Valley. This is Arizona here, this is Mexico here across the border, and California up here. So this is an extreme southwestern part of the state. It's very agriculturally intense and complex with all those different cropping seasons that we mentioned earlier. We want to look at group adoption ultimately on any individual community and examine the usage of those key insecticides and try to identify what is a cotton grower doing in this case. And in this example, we would hope that he forgoes the use of any use of neonicotinoids. Now, the land mass in the U.S. is organized around township ranges and sections, and each township is made up of 36 sections, each roughly a mile square, though we learned very quickly that surveyors didn't necessarily make all these nice, neat square boxes, but they're pretty good. And in general, 9 sections, or a 3x3 series of sections, is roughly equivalent to the community of interest. Again, we're only looking at section-level behaviors here. We're looking at the group adoption for all pesticide use for in a given section, and we're expressing that as the percentage of sprays, so the percentage of sprays that have a neonicotinoid. So again, we want to know if someone is growing in this focal section, what choices did they make based on the embedded community they're in? And for now, I'm going to just talk about the cotton uses here. So we'll look at the adoption by the cotton grower, since it seems to be most critical and most stringent. Now, anytime you're looking at a living system and one involving people, you're talking about one that's changing through time. So we're trying to measure adoption as a change through time. And there's several impinging factors. One is there are new products and new registrations coming on all the time. There are market forces that are pushing towards sales, towards adoption of these products. And with good reason, these are good products and have good uses within the marketplace. At the same time, we have differences in whitefly pressure, and they were fairly consistent through the early 2000s, but in 2005 we did have an outbreak year where the whitefly pressure was much higher. And we want to measure a behavior change. From the initiation of education and deployment of these guidelines in 2003, we'd like to see some sort of behavior change that shows a reduction in the rate of adoption of neonicotinoids by cotton growers. So I'm going to focus on just the extremes, the cotton intensive community in white and the multi-crop communities indicated in the pink here in all these analyses. And I'm also going to focus just on the two most agriculturally intense counties of the state. Probably 80 to 90% of all pesticide use is in either Yuma, either in Yuma or Pinal counties. And this is the bubble chart showing the number of cotton communities present in each of those counties. And you can see in Pinal County, it's dominated by more cotton-intensive regions, the white area there, and only a small sliver of what we would call multi-crop communities. And conversely, Yuma County is dominated by multi-crop regions and has only a small sliver of cotton-intensive regions. This is important to keep in mind as we look into some of the constraints to adoption. So here's the data. What we have here is an examination of the Yuma communities. So these are all cotton uses now, not any vegetable uses. So in the cotton communities, this is the usage of neonicotinoids through time. The percentage of sprays that used included a neonicotinoid. And you can see it went up from 2003 to 2005 pretty dramatically. Now in the multi-crop communities, we would hope that the usage would be zero. Now no system's perfect. But we did deploy our guidelines in 2003 and had workshops and educational outreach to go with this, and then re-emphasized it again in 2005. So that's the period in which we did our education. And here's what the cotton growers in the multi-crop regions were doing. They started out using more neonicotinoids than the equivalent cotton grower in a cotton-intensive region. And then there was a change. There was a fourfold change in behavior to the point where now cotton growers in a multi-crop region are actually using significantly fewer neonicotinoids than in the cotton-intensive regions of Yuma County. So this is very encouraging. It suggests to me that they were listening and they're paying attention and trying their best to deploy the guidelines, though it does also say that about 10% of the time there are sprays being made in multi-crop regions on cotton with neonicotinoids. So what about other compounds? Pyraproxivin is another whitefly active material, an insect growth regulator, and for those cotton growers in multi-crop regions, we ask them to use alternatives to neonicotinoids. And you can see in general, there's a drifting upwards slightly that they are using more and more of the IGRs. And as opposed to cotton growers in a cotton intensive region, the more they depended on neonicotinoids, the less they used pyraproxivin. So we're at least trending in the right direction of our hypotheses. Bupropion or Courier is another insect growth regulator with broad registrations. And in fact, we established cross-commodity guidelines on this several years earlier and asked that, in fact, the cotton growers in multi-crop regions discontinue the use or reduce their use of bupropion in favor of it and not use it in the cotton-intensive regions not use it in the multi-crop regions. And you can see that, in fact, it has gone down, though not significantly. We're talking fairly low uses of this material. Now, here's sort of the other side of the coin. You remember Pinal County is a county dominated by cotton-intensive regions, and in fact, the behaviors are totally different here. It looks as though they didn't hear our message at all and didn't do anything different between those two cropping communities. So something different has happened. Now, looking at a totally independent database, this is a series of user reports. We have an organized set of meetings to establish cotton pesticide use patterns throughout the state and part of our cotton insect losses workshops. And it's not completely comparable to the other data we've seen, but this is all the uses of acetamiprid, the number one neonicotinoid used foliarly in cotton, for Yuma County versus the rest of the state below 2,000 feet elevation, which would be similar agricultural areas to Yuma. And you can see in general in the rest of the state, there is heavy use of this neonicotinoid, very heavy in 2005, an outbreak year, but decidedly lower in the multi-crop areas, the more likely to be multi-cropped areas of Yuma. So about a 4.4-fold difference. We followed this up with some PCA interviews, and I say we. It's really Al Fournier pictured there. He didn't necessarily have a nice meal with each PCA, but he's toasting us there. And in fact, did PCA interviews. Al has skills in evaluation and implemented an interview guide approach and spent about 90 minutes with 12 different PCAs representing three major growing regions of the state. It doesn't sound like a lot of people, but they do represent a huge amount of the market share of the sprays that are being made. About a third of the cotton sprays were managed by these PCAs, and over half of the melon sprays and 16% of the vegetable sprays during this 2001 to 2005 period. He asked them about their knowledge of the guidelines, some of the assumptions, both ours and theirs, and what improvements we could make. And so far, we have a preliminary qualitative analysis. And this is what we've basically found. The positive factors towards adoption are things that, thank goodness, we can look towards here in extension, and that is, yes, our outreach programs were having an impact. They were hearing them, they were listening and subscribing. But other things have changed. Now, some of these changes have occurred since this period, since 2005. But one is the introduction of new aphicides, in particular flonicamid. Very good to have some options for them because they were depending on neonicotinoids for aphid control in their lettuce crops, particularly in the winter. There's also a fair amount of unwitting adoption. In other words, some of these PCAs really not too familiar with the guidelines, but if you look at their actual usage patterns, they're unwittingly adopting what we recommend. And then there has been lower whitefly pressure in recent years, since 2005, and they all note that as being a positive factor. There are negative factors, however, and that is there's some flawed assumptions by these PCAs about the communities in which they are embedded. And in Pinal County in particular, there are PCAs that did not acknowledge that there were multi-crop communities that they were working within. And remember, that was just a small sliver of the communities. So these things influence them as well as the things we're all used to. The grower influences them, the price influences them, and a number of situational factors. And lastly, they all call into question whether they can properly perceive what the landscape will look like in a two-mile radius around them on an annual cycle. And certainly that is an issue that we have to deal with. We have another source of data. This is from our vegetable insect loss sessions that John Plumbo runs. This is a graph showing adoption and non-adoption for neonicotinoids in lettuce. Now, we're looking at what the lettuce growers are doing around the same period of time. And what we infer from this is if they're using a soil use of neonicotinoid, they shouldn't be using a foliar neonicotinoid over the top. That's part of our guidelines. So if we plot this, the foliar uses versus soil uses, this user put 70% out by soil and 20% foliar, that's total 90%. So clearly he's using less than 100% of his acreage getting a neonicotinoid, and it doesn't look like he's doubled up on any of it. Whereas a grower over here puts 100% soil use and comes back and hits 50% of it with a foliar use, then he's definitely violating our guidelines, if not some of the recommendations and some of the labels. So how'd we do? Well, from our surveys, it looks like not too bad. The majority of the fall lettuce growers are in fact subscribing, though there are 9 instances out of 53 where you have some of these that fall into the non-adoption zone. Most of them pretty close to the baseline. This one's of concern, 100% use by soil and 90% followed up with a foliar treatment. So that's not a very good practice. However, move to spring lettuce and everything changes. It almost looks like a different community. And what we find here is, in fact, that reference to aphicides. These are growers in the winter who are trying to battle not whiteflies, but aphids, and do depend on the neonicotinoids to do that. And so definitely there's an issue here. Different target. They're not really perceiving that they're going after whitefly at this time. So where does this leave us? Performance. And here's another series of studies that John Plumbo has done over years, showing the percent reductions in whitefly numbers versus time here, from 1998 all the way to 2008. And you can see back in the late 90s, we were getting around 90% control in his performance assays. And now we're in the 50% range. And yet, growers weren't changing their behaviors until just the last 2 years, in which we now see, and these 2 points were affected by cooperator oversprays. So our extension model is alive and well. We identified a problem through stakeholder feedback. We identified these risks. We developed a bulletin and deployed it through workshops. I think what distinguishes this is we then came back and tried to assess very specifically and measure the impacts and changes in our clients. And we do see that they are listening, though not completely, remembering these are just voluntary guidelines. And then, of course, there's feedback here. We have had some changes in performance. We do need to make adjustments. There are a lot of new products here and also coming that may assist us. So if we add the imidacloprid line, we can see that, in fact, what's interesting here is we really don't see any changes in these typical bioassays. Tim Dennehy's work over a decade really hasn't shown any change in the neonicotinoid response. However, John's data clearly shows there's a reduced performance, and it does appear that they are starting to change their management practices as a result. So this just shows us that, in fact, resistance is a complex issue and needs to be thought of in all three of these realms. Appreciate your interest, and I do have one copy of the guidelines if anyone would like to look at them in more detail.